Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 47, White Plains. So I'm sorry for taking the last week off. I unfortunately have been dealing with some really bad allergies that have just been really messing up my system. I've been congested, coughing, and that's probably why I sound like I'm talking through a styrofoam cup. So when last we left off, we were talking about the battle at Pell's Point. This was the delaying action that Washington and his army needed. When Howe landed in the Throgs Neck area, Washington really hadn't even got the army underway to move back to White Plains. So Throgs Neck coupled with Pell's Point bought Washington some much-needed time. Now, I did talk about how the American army was being reorganized. Charles Lee had come up from the south and had joined the army. They also got two more additions. Sullivan and Sterling were both released on a prisoner exchange. The army was now reformed into seven new divisions. Nathaniel Greene, Charles Lee, Heath, Sullivan, Spencer, and Benjamin Lincoln. Now, General Greene is pretty much out of our story when we're talking about White Plains because he's going to be with 3,500 men manning the fort in New Jersey named Fort Lee. While he'll have under his command another 1,500 men under Colonel Robert McGaw, still holding the lines at Fort Washington on Manhattan Island. So when Howe leaves his camp at Eastchester on October 19th, Washington hadn't fully consolidated his forces in White Plains just yet. Howe had available to him 4,000 grenadiers, light infantry, and Jaegers. Had he hit the American column now as they were moving up into White Plains, he could have thrown Washington's army completely out of whack. Fact is he didn't. No, instead, he moved his army from Eastchester to New Rochelle, where he camped there for three whole days. Then he moved to Mamaroneck, which was only 3 miles away, and camped for another 4 days. It wouldn't be until the 28th of October that Howe arrives in front of the American position at White Plains, a full 10 days later. Now, I know we've talked several times about Howe and his delaying, and sometimes it makes sense, sometimes there's reasoning behind it. This is, again, one of the cases where I can't see it. He took 10 days to travel 17 miles. He's averaging less than 2 miles a day. About the only positive that came out of this 10-day waiting period is the 2nd Grand Division of Germans under Lieutenant General Wilhelm von Knappenhausen. In that same convoy, another 6,000 fresh British recruits arrived from England as well. So Howe has the numbers. He's just taking his time. And Washington is the benefactor. He has been in his position for 7 days. His army is consolidated, is ready for a fight, and they know the land in front of them. So it's no surprise that when the British advance guard arrives on the morning of the 28th, Washington is ready for the fight. Spencer takes 1,500 men and sets up behind a stone wall about a mile and a half ahead of the American position. As the British advance closes in, they open up a volley on them and keep him held in position for what would seem like all day. But a Hessian regiment under Johann Rahl will come to the rescue of the British advance, and they will actually outflank the Americans. So Spencer will have to change positions, and he sets up behind another stone wall, and it has much of the same outcome. Rahl comes on, almost outflanks him, and he retreats. And then when the Americans set up in a new position, the British advance guard and Rahl come on again. Once again, Rahl almost outflanks him, and he's sent to retreat again. And this leapfrogging continues all the way to Chatterton's Hill. The hill is just to the west of the town of White Plains on the other side of the Bronx River. And that's where Spencer is going to pull back to. There was definitely some up-close-and-personal fighting during this time, because one American officer actually describes a volley that was delivered at such a close range that it scattered them like leaves in the whirlwind. They ran off so far that some Americans ran onto the ground where they brought off their arms, accoutrements, and rum that the men who fell had with them, which we had time to drink rounds before they came on again. So Rahl has driven Spencer back to Chatterton's Hill, where two militia regiments under the command of Colonel Rufus Putnam, now Rufus Putnam is not related to General Israel Putnam, were constructing fortifications. Under the fire between Spencer's men and Rufus Putnam's militia, Rahl has to retreat to a small hill south of the American position of Chatterton. The American casualties in this running and gunning were 12 killed, 23 wounded, and 2 missing. Now, unfortunately, once again, we don't have any reports on what happened to the Hessians because Hessian numbers were not recorded, and there was nothing stating what the British casualties were from their advance guard. But I'm assuming that the casualties were much higher than the Americans because the Americans the whole time, though they were almost outflanked several times, held the stronger position behind the stone wall and were delivering successive volleys into the open ranks of the British and the Germans. So I would say that the edge to the running and gunning of the advance guards goes to the Americans. Now, Chatterton's Hill is about 3/4 mile wide at the top and arose 180 feet above the Bronx River, which ran along the east side. The hill at that point was actually the steepest and most densely wooded. So the best place to attack the hill would be from the south. Washington knew that the British would attempt to get guns up on the high ground, so he sent troops to reinforce Putnam's militia. The first regiment that he sends is under Colonel John Hazlitt, and it's the 1st Delaware, of which I am currently part of the reenactment group, so a big shout out to those in the 1st Delaware. They took a position just below the top of the hill. General Alexander McDougall would move his brigade to the hill as well. His brigade consisted of his own 1st New York, Rezima's 3rd New York, Smallwood's 1st Maryland Regiment, and they were also being reinforced by Charles Webb's 7th Connecticut Regiment after the loss of the Marylanders at Brooklyn. So the American line as it stands are the two militia regiments under Brooks from Massachusetts and Graham from New York, overall commanded by Putnam, of course, were being placed to the right. Hazlitt and Smallwood were being held in the center. Then McDougall, Rezima, and Webb would close in on the left. The whole force on the top of the hill was something around 1,250 men. As the senior officer on the scene, McDougall would take command. Now, the British Army by this point had arrived on the plains outside of the town of White Plains. There they halted and consulted on what they were going to do next. Well, they decided they were going to take the heights first. A force of 4,000 would be sent to take the hill. The other 10,000 sat on the ground, there in their ranks, as if they were going to watch a play and the curtain was about to rise. The British Army moved into a position on a small hill just south of Chatterton Hill. This is the same small hill that Rahl had fallen back to after he had chased Spencer to that same position. The British artillery opened on the American position at the top of the hill. While the cannonading was going on, the British began to deploy into line of battle on the other side of the Bronx River. Now, the Americans had artillery of their own, but unfortunately, the men that were manning these two field pieces were not the most reliable. John Hazlitt will actually write of an instance where the piece was so poorly appointed that I myself was forced in to assist dragging it along in the rear of the regiment. While so employed, a cannonball struck that carriage and scattered shot about, and a wad of blazing tow in the middle. The artillerymen fled. The few that returned made not more than 2 discharges when they retreated with the field piece. So unfortunately, McDougall's men would have to go without artillery for this battle. So while the British artillery, that is, was wreaking havoc on the American guns, the British infantry was forming up on the opposite side of the Bronx River. Colonel Carl von Dunnop and his Hessian grenadiers were the ones that were given the high honor of crossing the river to lead the attack. But for this time of year, the Bronx River was actually abnormally high, and von Dunnop refused. So he set his men to begin work on an impromptu bridge. Well, while they're working on this bridge, Smallwood and Rezima had come from the top of the hill, about halfway down the hill, and set their men up and began firing on the British and the Hessians. Well, under this attack, it's causing a lot of problems. And British General Alexander Leslie, who is also the commander of this assault, learns that there is a ford not too far up the river. So he orders two regiments, the 28th and the 35th, to cross at the ford and show the Hessians what true British bravery is all about. When he gets his men across the river, he orders them to bayonet charge Smallwood and Redzima's regiments. The only problem was, is that when they got, the hill was so steep, and the trees were so thick, and the American fire was so blistering, that all that ended up happening was that these two regiments got pushed back into two more regiments that were crossing the river, the 5th and the 49th. Von Dunham's men had finished their impromptu bridge and had gotten themselves across. So the British had to get themselves reorganized, and they began to move parallel at the base of the hill, where they were going to all set up in line of battle, and they were collectively going to march up the hill. So as they begin marching up the hill, the British cannons stop. They didn't want to impede the attack in any way. Redzima and Smallwood are actually going to try and hold their position about halfway up the hill, but under the pressure, they are forced to move back to their original position. Now, the American line is holding. They have the British about three-quarters of the way up the hill, and they're in a strong position at the top of the hill, and it's much easier to fire down a hill than it is to fire up a hill, so the Americans, at this point, are looking really good. The British are going to call up some reserves. They have Rahl sitting in position with the British artillery to the south of Chatterton. So Rahl moves his men into position. His plan is to attack the American right and the Green Militia under Putnam. Now, this wasn't a poor showing for the militia. They fire a good volley against Rahl, and they hold him in check. But along with Rahl coming into the battle, so did Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Birch's 17th Light Dragoons. And though they were able to check the Hessians for a moment, Birch's men charged the militia, who broke and ran instantly. The militia had never seen light horse in action, so they fled, leaving exposed the right of the Delaware regiment. Hazlitt is a fighter. You gotta give the man that. Instead of cutting and running, which would probably have been the easy thing to do, and completely exposing the center of the American line, he refused the right. He created a new line at a 90-degree angle. This way he can meet Rahl and Birch, while preserving the integrity of the center of the American line. So twice Rahl and Birch will attack the Delaware, and twice Hazlitt's men will repel them. But McDougal sees what's happening, and he knows that he has to retreat. There is no way they're going to be able to hold this position at their current state, though they're doing fantastic, but the British have made it to the top of the hill. And so they're going to have to retreat sooner or later because they're not going to be able to hold out. Plus, some of the regiments were running out of ammunition. They were doing so much firing. So the first regiments to go were the 3rd New York and the 1st Maryland, which also held the 7th Connecticut, under Smallwood and Redzima. They would pull out first. McDougal would hold the 1st at the top of the hill, the 1st New York, so that he could ensure that Hazlitt's 1st Delaware would be able to make the retreat down the hill as well. And lastly, McDougal would leave, and the British would ascend the hill victorious. Now, the British reformed into ranks, and they were, making a show like they were going to give chase, but they had no plans on it. The fight that they had just went through was a tough one. By the numbers, it doesn't look so impressive on the scale of things in the American Revolution. You have 175 killed or wounded on the American side of things. The British will report 28 killed, including 5 officers, with another 126 wounded, while the Hessians will report 77 casualties of their own. But we've seen this before. The British alter numbers. They've won the battle. By all intents and purposes, they have won the battle. They took the ground. And on the European style of things, if you take the ground, well, you claim victory. And because they were the victorious ones, they're the ones that get to dictate the numbers. And so it's the same thing we've seen. They're reporting faulty numbers so that it doesn't look so bad for their situation. I would say that The Americans probably killed a few more than what the British recorded, but you got to remember, too, Chatterton's Hill, as I mentioned several times, was steep and heavily wooded. So there was a lot of places for the British to take cover behind, just like the Americans. So it was a back-and-forth fight in a tough area. And honestly, I think that both sides executed their plans effectively. Calling in Rahl and Birch to outflank the American position was genius. I would have stuck the militia dead in the center, but then you risk them breaking at the center and folding in two parts of the line instead of just the right, which Hazlitt handled fantastically. So, you know, there was really no easy way for the Americans to win this fight because the British had more numbers. Washington is going to hang out in his position in White Plains for a few more days. The British are on the hill. Washington still holds the town. So he's going to stay here, and he's going to move his men to North Castle on the night of October 31st. North Castle was on the Hudson. From there, he's going to cross the Hudson and head into New Jersey. The plan is to get to New Jersey and figure out what's next. For Howe, he's going to do some soul-searching of his own. He has now 20,000 men in his mobile army, not including those troops that are stationed in and around the New York City area, and not including those troops up in Canada. So Howe's army in the field is 20,000, and he has yet to been able to wipe Washington from it. Washington's ability as a commander will be called into question several times over this podcast, and I just would say to those men, if I was in 1776 or 1778 or 79 or 80, look at New York. Howe could have easily wiped Washington from the field several different times and didn't. He failed to win the numbers game, and Washington is. Throg's Neck and White Plains were checks. Washington's men held Howe in check. And Howe is playing right into Washington's hands. He's slow. He's methodical about his moves. You know, not methodical in a good way either. Not like they're planned out all that well. You should not take 10 days to move 17 miles. Just shouldn't happen. And Washington is winning this fight. Until next week. Yes, I pause for dramatic effect. Next week, we're going to talk about Fort Washington. This will be a blow to Washington and at least a little bit of a redemption for Howe. The next two episodes are, as it stands, the end of the New York campaign. We are going to spend some time talking about the battle at White Plains, followed up the retreat into New Jersey. From there, we're going to set up for the next major campaign. My plan is to, we're going to see where we're at. Remember, go on the Facebook. I want to know where we're going next. Do we want to go north and talk about Benedict Arnold and Valcour Island and all the great things that are happening there? Or do we want to talk about, spend a little bit of time talking about some fun, interesting ways that the Continental Army will try and blockade the Hudson River and its importance to the protection of the American colonies? So let me know, because I did post a poll out there, and I have checked. I'm going to check the new numbers and see where we're at, but I hope people go onto the Facebook and check it out. Give me some feedback on what you guys want to hear next. Like I said, I apologize. The allergies were killer. I know this isn't the best sound quality of a podcast this week, but the toll that the pollen takes on the body is pretty ridiculous at this time of year, so I am sorry for that. Next week will be Fort Washington. The week after that will be the retreat through New Jersey, and then from there is a mystery. I let you as a listener tell me where we're going to go next. Are we going north, or are we talking about naval warfare? Until then, as always, everyone have a happy and safe week, and keep the powder dry.